The information contained in this podcast is not financial nor investment advice. All trades and investments are my own. All opinions are my own and should not be construed as advice. If you do decide to trade or invest in any of the markets discussed, you do so at your own risk. Welcome to episode 18 of the Blockchain Immersive Podcast. Sorry, I'm a little late at releasing this podcast. Again, I have a lot going on in my own life, good things, but it's taking a long time for me to get everything together. But once that change takes place, I will let you know. It should take place within the next month. So it's going to be a little busy for me, so I may or may not be able to produce a podcast every week, at least until it is resolved. But again, it's all good. Nothing to worry about. So we have a lot of news from last week, and very interesting news. And so let's just get right to it. This piece of news here, the new MasterCard program looks to offer crypto capabilities to banks. Now, this is big. Remember, now the market is down, right? Everyone, all the normal, you know, sort of everyday retail investors are sleeping right now. They don't want to be in cryptocurrencies, right? And remember, I've told you many times, it's the smart money getting in now and the smart people learning about it now. So as you can see, MasterCard, you know, one of the largest credit card companies in the world is now looking to expand into crypto for most of these banks. So this is huge because you remember when crypto first came out, the credit cards were a little bit cautious about it, right? Some of them even denied it, saying, no, you cannot buy crypto with a credit card. You can with a debit card, but not a credit card. Now it looks like things have changed, and MasterCard is one of the first to get this out there. Next piece of news is Israel's government and Tel Aviv Stock Exchange preparing to issue digital state bond, and it's going to be blockchain-based. So again, you see, the underlying technology is incredibly useful, and governments all over the world, not just Israel, they're now incorporating it into their main financial offerings. So this is big, and this will not be the last time we hear a government do this. Actually, in relation to that, the next topic is this. The U.S., in order for the U.S. to remain competitive, they too have to issue a government-backed digital security, a digital token or coin. And this is big. The fact that government officials in the United States are saying, we need to do this. We need to build a system based on digital currency. And so again, this is huge because think about it, the whole economy is sort of pretty much digital at this point. So this is very important to keep in mind. The next piece of news is PayPal integrates with Bitstamp. Bitstamp is a cryptocurrency exchange. And this is also big news. So although PayPal offers their own way of getting in and out of cryptocurrencies, by being integrated with an exchange, it means you can fund your account, your cryptocurrency account with Bitstamp, through PayPal, something that was not possible before. So now it looks like this is the beginning of more and more cryptocurrency integration. And look at when it's happening, when the market is down. People are sleeping, but the smart people are learning about this. And that's why I really hope that you had a chance to take some of my courses that I can show you how this market really works and to be ahead of the curve. Next piece of news. Investing app Stash raises $52.6 million weeks after expanding access to cryptocurrency. So another big thing. This app, Stash, allows you to sort of save money incrementally and put it into like stocks and things of that nature. Now, when they expanded into cryptocurrencies, who comes calling? All the venture capitalists and all the investors are like, oh, okay, now we'll lend you some more money. And that's exactly what happened here. So you see, everyone's getting in slowly but surely. But again, the retail investor is sleeping during this time. Next piece of news. The CFTC's Benham calls FTX idea potential evolution in market structure. CFTC is the regulatory body for the commodity futures and Forex and things like that. So what FTX is a big cryptocurrency exchange. And what they were proposing was that they would be sort of like a clearinghouse for cryptocurrency trades. And the thing is that they would clear the customer orders. And this is what goes on in commodities. You have clearinghouses processing the orders for commodity trades. So FTX is proposing to sort of become a clearinghouse itself. This would, of course, allow regulators to keep a better hold on it, so then fraud is not prevalent. But it also, how can I put this? It also adds legitimacy of cryptocurrencies to the regulatory community. Because you remember, the regulatory community is very touch and go with cryptocurrencies, but as you can see, they are slowly getting in line. We've already been there, though, those of us who have been investing in cryptocurrencies and learning about it, we're already way ahead of them. So they're just catching up to us. But the fact that they are catching up means that more money is going to be pushed into it, which means more opportunity for those of us who are getting into this market. So that's what I'm saying. It's so important to learn about this market, even if you don't invest in it. To learn about it is very important, and that's what I offer at blockchainimmersive.com. All right, so this is the end of the news section. In the next section, I'm going to take you through the trade of the week or Trader's Corner. I had a delay of a few days because, I'm going through a sort of a massive life change, so I was delayed for a few days. But you'll see there's one or two trades there. Not too bad. They one resolved sort of, you know, mediocre, and one is doing pretty well right now. And it's an Ethereum. And okay, let's get to that. Oh, and just one more thing. After the trade of the week, I'm going to explain CDOs, or collateralized debt obligations, and mortgage-backed securities, and more broadly how they related to the 2008 recession. So that'll be at the end of this podcast. Okay, so welcome to Trader's Corner or Trade of the Week. I don't know why I keep on going between the names. Anyway, it's either one of them. So remember last week's podcast, I went long here, just a few points shy of this signal. And I said, well, I would get in until I got a sell signal. And the thing is interestingly enough, my system did not generate a sell signal through all of this, which is really interesting. So I just stayed in, right? I didn't even get a take profit, you know, one of these things here. So I just stayed in. And good thing I did, because now it's back up in the 316. So this is a great trade. So obviously it hasn't resolved yet. But I suspect that because it is only Monday, I suspect within the next 5 days, this will resolve in some way. I might get out here on the top. I mean, we'll see. So I just wanted to update you on that. I'm also thinking I might start this with the next podcast. I might want to look at another coin too. I mean, I'll still trade Ethereum, but, you know, maybe we'll, maybe we'll experiment with Bitcoin or something, you know, just to freshen it up a little bit. So we did the Solana, we did Ethereum, and now maybe we'll do Bitcoin with the next podcast. We'll see. I have to look at the range and make sure it's something I want to do. I mean, I have a long-term position in Bitcoin, but I'm talking about like trading. I don't tend to trade Bitcoin a lot. I tend to trade the Ethereums, the Solanas, the Ripples, the other coins, but I mean, the system will do the same thing, so there's really no difference. So, all right, well, that's it for this first video. I do suspect that we will resolve this trade at some point soon, because we are at this upper level here, which means that there could be a pullback. So I will see you in that video. Okay, just wanted to update you on this trade. I did get a take profit here at 1325.39. And that was a nice trade. I got in around 1245. So that's not bad. Not quite 100 points, but not bad at all. So now I'm waiting for a sell signal because we are really, really overbought here. And we'll see how it goes. Hi, so I just wanted to update you. We did get a sell signal with an entry of 1318.81. However, I was a little late at getting in because I was distracted by other things. So I ended up shorting at 1308.62, which is, it's $10 away from below the entry price. So I didn't get in exactly when the sell signal came in, but I'm still short. And the market at this point is only, $4 against me, so it's no big deal. But we still have some room to move to the downside, so I guess we'll see what happens there. I'll keep you updated. Hopefully we will have this trade resolved by the time this podcast is out. If not, it'll roll into the next podcast. Hey, so I wanted to update you on that short. I've been away for a little bit for a few days because I have a lot of stuff going on. So I was able to conclude that trade. It was mildly profitable, right? I got short at 1308.62. I covered my short at 1289.82. And so that wasn't significant. An 18-point move on that. And then I went long also at this point, and I'm still in. And that trade is probably going to resolve the following week, but we'll see what happens. And that's the end of the trade of the week or Trader's Corner this week. Hey there. I know I said the last video was going to be the last one about trading, but I had to add this. As you can see, I'm still long. Remember from this point, look where we are now. We are at 1462. The high was 1513. So 1513 minus my entry point. And that is 223 points times my usual contract. And this is over $3,000 in the money right now. It's a great trade. This is one of the better ones, right? So I'm still in. So I'm probably going to give up some of that because, saw the spike. I obviously didn't get up top here. That would have been the maximum profits. But we're at 1461. There's huge volatility here. I'm just going to wait until I get a signal to get out. This is a very profitable trade. And I had to add it into this podcast because I still had a little room to put this in the production. So, but that's it for the trading podcast, trading part of this podcast. Okay, so I am going to discuss CDOs or collateralized debt obligations, but really I'm going to talk more broadly about what happened in 2008 when we went into a global recession, because CDOs do play a part in that, a very major part. And during that time, I was working at Merrill Lynch Bank of America as a compliance analyst, and I saw the first signs coming through. And of course, no one knew. I didn't know. No one knew what was happening. But I do recall, even before that time, I saw something in the bond market that just didn't look right. And I actually have a few witnesses. I told them, look, something is wrong here. I don't know what's going on with these interest rates. But who knew that that would actually be a portent of what was going to come? But that's besides the point. So basically, as you probably know, in 2008, we experienced a global recession. This recession was mainly caused by a crisis in the housing market in the United States, and it impacted various different markets all around the world, and it had such tentacles everywhere. And during the time preceding that recession, we were in a low interest rate environment. This means that money was cheap, and this was coupled with this notion that the American dream to own a home was everyone's right, whether you could afford it or not. And let me just tell you, I'm all for home ownership, and I think everyone should get a chance to own a home. That is not the problem. The problem is that the mortgage brokers, and by extension, some of the mortgage banks, were giving people mortgages on homes even if they had no income. And these were called NINA loans, or no income, no asset mortgages. I mean, look, it's one thing if there was a low income. Low income is fine, but no income and no credit at all was a bit of a stretch, but the bankers didn't care. They kept lending to people who couldn't afford it, but were telling those people, oh yeah, you'll be fine, you can afford it. Now, why do you think they did this? And that's because these mortgage brokers and bankers get loan origination fees, and they are often, you know, 1 to 2% of the loan amount, sometimes even more. So let's just say that the average loan was $200,000, right? That means an origination fee between $2,000 and $4,000 per loan. God knows what other fees they had. They were, and mind you, they were originating dozens of these a day. You know, for one company could do dozens of them. So mortgage brokers and bankers were rolling in the money for years prior to the 2008 recession. And it was really easy for them because there was a glut of housing, and everyone and their mothers wanted to own a piece of the American dream. And they thought that they could afford it. And some knew that they couldn't, but the banks gave them a loan anyway. Now, because the mortgage brokers and bankers were blinded by these fees, they lost sight of their duties to make sure that the people who borrowed could actually pay for this. So they, one way they circumvented this was they offered ARM loans, or adjustable rate mortgages. And basically what it is, it starts off with a lower rate, like a teaser rate, but it says in the fine print that the loan's interest rate would go up significantly in the future. But the bankers failed to stress this. And so you had not, they didn't omit it. It was in the documentation, but they failed to stress it. And so young couples who were told they could buy the home, they were excited to buy it, and they did. Or speculators who were buying up properties left and right, because they wanted to flip them, they didn't care. Some of them didn't even know about these higher interest rates that were to come. And some of these people who were flipping, they didn't care. They said, oh, I'll already offload that property before that happens. Now, the thing is these mortgage banks don't have unlimited amounts of money to lend. They have certain requirements that they can only lend beyond a certain amount because they need to have some type of ratio for regulatory purposes. Now, to be honest, the mortgage banks and the mortgage brokers could care less for these loans at this point. They got their origination fees, and the interest at that point was nominal. So they knocked on the door of the investment banks, who were more than willing to buy the loans off these mortgage banks. And this purchase of the loan supplied cash to the mortgage bankers, who then originated more loans, collected more fees, and then when they were at capacity, they sold the loans off to Wall Street again. Now, you might think, why does Wall Street want these loans? I mean, the interest rates were so low. Well, it's certainly not because they wanted to sit on them for 30 years. No. That's too slow. Wall Street is a fast-moving environment. To wait 30 years on an interest rate they're not doing that. What they did was that they took a bunch of these loans of various qualities, meaning some of the borrowers had good credit, some of them did not, and put them together in like a bundle. And it just didn't matter at that point who was the weaker borrower, the stronger borrower. When you put them together, the rationale was that the strong borrowers would mitigate the losses from the weaker ones. So what they did was package the loans into something called a mortgage-backed security, which is a CDO, which is a collateralized debt obligation, but for mortgages. So they diced up these loans and created investment vehicles based on them. So in some cases, they sold off the interest portion of a loan to some investors, and to other investors, they sold off the principal payments to other investors. And because the loans were bundled in the thousands, the rating agencies agreed with the bankers and said, well, because there are so many of these, chances are these won't default, and they gave them like a high rating. So they gave these high ratings, and this gave reassurance to the banks, gave reassurance to the investors who were purchasing through the banks, the investment banks, that is. So the banks then pushed these bundled CDOs to investors, and they were making a fortune. I mean, they were a fortune, and they kept on doing this because housing prices were going through the roof and demand for these loans was tremendous. So now all these loans together are, you know, packaged, and everyone wants a piece of it, everyone. Now, here's the kicker. Those same banks that bought these loans and bundled them needed more loans to bundle and to keep on selling to the investors because they wanted those fees. And those fees were in the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions. Now, these banks were no fools, right? When they purchased these mortgages, they also bought default insurance on them. They had to, because even though they bought all these mortgages, they couldn't buy unlimited amounts of mortgages because they had to have a cash ratio. They have to make sure that their risk isn't too high. So if you buy default insurance against a portfolio of mortgages, it essentially takes it off your books because you no longer risk. Your risk is not there anymore. It's either the entire risk is mitigated or you may take a small loss if, let's say, they defaulted because the insurance would cover it. So by buying the insurance, they essentially took those loans off the books so then they could buy more loans from these mortgage people. But here's the perverse thing. The investment banks didn't even use cash to buy these loans. They borrowed money to buy them. So now the thing is that, you know, that's incredible. So not only did they make money, they used borrowed money to continue this investment scheme. And that's just crazy. But one thing that was really odd is that these insurance companies would often sometimes write policies, more than one policy, on the same mortgage bundle. And that's obscene. It would be as if you bought homeowners insurance for your house and bought two policies with the same company. And if the house, you know, sprung a leak or burned down, the insurance company would pay you double. That doesn't happen, right? The insurance company is not going to pay you double. You can't buy two. You have the one homeowner's insurance. An insurance company is not going to insure the house twice, right? But these insurance companies did do that. For these CDOs. So that's just insane right off the bat. So if these CDOs defaulted, the insurance companies would have to pay no matter how many policies they wrote against a given CDO. And by the way, these insurance products are called credit default swaps. You know, by now, these CDOs are not only coming in hot and heavy, they are also now insured. And so this juggernaut of loan origination, loan packaging into CDO and insurance was just barreling down the street. But as with most low interest rate environments, too much money is being pumped into the system, and that starts to cause inflation. The government, as it is prone to do, will raise interest rates when inflation pops its ugly head up, just like they're doing now. So what happened? Not only does interest rates go up, but those adjustable rate mortgages that they signed off to those people who couldn't really afford it reset at much higher rates, and suddenly people couldn't afford their mortgages anymore. From the person who really couldn't afford one in the first place to the person who bought a dozen homes hoping they could flip them before the recession came. Mortgages started to tank and defaults were on the rise. The investment banks and their clients were holding a boatload of these packaged mortgages, and now suddenly those mortgages were going south, and many of them were defaulting. But, you know, at first they didn't worry because they have insurance, right? I mean, they bought all of this credit default swaps. But the problem is that so many of them started to default that the insurance companies couldn't pay the claims. This led to banks booking massive losses on their mortgage-backed securities and their CDOs. And the loans they took to buy those loans in the first place forced them to either go bankrupt or disappear completely, And if those were had the good fortune of being too big to fail, either merged or were bailed out by the government. So now the broader question is, how and why did this impact the whole world? Well, remember, these investment banks selling the CDOs, right? Their clients were countries, you know, full countries, pension funds from around the world, other banks from around the world. And so it took whole industries down around the world. But even for those banks that didn't buy those loans, they were impacted too. And those companies that have nothing to do with the mortgage business, because they borrow money, they were impacted too. And the banking system in general, the monetary system we have here, is based in large part by overnight and short-term lending between banks to fund day-to-day operations. And the thing is that because these banks were losing so much money on their CDOs and their mortgage backs, overnight short-term capital started to dry up. Companies such as GE, for example, that rely on short-term loans called commercial paper, couldn't get funded properly because there was no cash in the system. Everything was starting to freeze up. So even industries that didn't have a direct connection to the mortgage market were impacted. And the U.S. government itself also insured many loans. And because the market was tanking, the reputation started to tank. And countries around the world were like, oh, maybe we should dump U.S. bonds. And that would have caused more than a recession. But it was such a vicious cycle. And all this probably would not have happened if the mortgage bankers didn't originate loans to people who couldn't pay, and if Wall Street didn't have a voracious appetite for creating CDOs and mortgage-backed securities. Now, of course, there are other mitigating factors, but the CDO industry was a major, major factor. And yes, CDOs are still created to this day, and it is larger than ever. But now they might be a little bit more selective about the loans being included in the mortgage pools. And they go through regular, what they call, quote unquote, stress tests. So now that they can sort of forecast, okay, what would happen if this scenario happened and this scenario happened? And I'm sure they're being tested to this day right now because of the situations that are going on right now economically. So anyway, with that is the end of this podcast. I will see you in the next one.